Good morning and welcome back to Fear or Favour. Well, a very busy week and a very sad week. We have the tragic death of Olivia in Liverpool. Nazir, it's been a year since there's been any firearm shootings on the streets of Liverpool. And now in a matter of a week, we have three with the tragic death of the young girl. What's going wrong?
It's also, it was quite a stunning coincidence. It's the 15th anniversary of the murder of Rhys Jones on the streets of Liverpool, that 11-year-old boy that was shot when people were trying to aim at somebody else. So it's a bit of a massive coincidence that the same thing happened to Olivia on the same day, 15 years on. What's going on? Obviously, somebody's got access to firearms. You and I know it's really difficult to get a hold of a firearm in the UK, and we're so glad that we're in that position rather than some of our brothers and sisters in the United States, for example. The National Crime Agency have been working really hard, working particularly with European authorities to prevent the importing of firearms. But of course, there will be firearms here that just need to be reactivated. Appears that a group or a gang, or maybe several gangs, have access to these firearms and they're not afraid to use them. And
it's interesting that it's been dipped for a year, though. So the Merseyside police have obviously taken a very proactive stance.
And I think we talked before about EncroChat, haven't we? And the Merseyside police, you know, had access to lots of messaging and phone connections between organised crime gangs. And that undoubtedly has led to significant intelligence wins. And they've been able to take a number of bad guys off the street. And I've no doubt they've been able to take a number of weapons off the street, too. However, you know, that's moved on. New people come in. You know, all the stuff. I live in Manchester, as you know, and I'm amazed that when you talk about the Ibiza drug problem, it's between Liverpool and Manchester gangs. You know, what the hell are they doing over there? But they seem to fight on different territories over narcotics or something similar. So we're in the summer. We know that when in the summer the drug trade goes up, I have little doubt that this is connected to that in some way, shape, or form, or so certainly some historical issues arising from that. I also have no doubt that the police will get on top of it. But right now, you know, poor Olivia was just in her home. She had nothing whatsoever to do with any of these criminals. One of them runs into her home. As a result, she ends up dead and her mother is injured. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that people in Liverpool and Merseyside are quite scared right now.
And there's a really shocking detail about that. There's a really shocking detail, isn't there, Nazir, about
because the gang turned up to take their man away and left her dying. And, you know, that's just the lowest of the low. Isn't it? I mean, I can't begin to think what must be going through their minds, thinking, all right, we've got to get our guy out. Forget the fact that a 9-year-old child is dying in the living room. You know, it really does give you a feel of what we're dealing with here, people who just don't care. And they demonstrated that big time.
I mean, what it does tell us is, you know, gun crime, of course, has been on the increase in certain areas, but there's also, it is very, very... it's still very minimal in terms of the amount of crime that does take place. And of course, what we do tend to see with gun crime, it is gang on gang.
Yeah. I mean, I hate the phrase, Olivia was collateral damage. You know, she is a young girl who had a life ahead of her. But literally, they aim at each other and they try and, it's, you know, often territory, or it might simply be, as I say, might be historical baggage, i.e. something somebody did a while ago, and that this is what they intend to do to that person. But yeah, you're absolutely right to point to gun crime being relatively, it's not out of control, but, you know, rising. But of course, knife crime has been rising too. And in fact, violent crime generally has been rising over the last year or two. And some of that they put down to the post-COVID effect. You know, people are back out now, and that's one of the reasons why it's going up. Some of it, of course, must be down to the cost of living. You know, that means that criminals are trying to find opportunities to make money, and illegal money, and that has undoubtedly impacted on that too. Some of the, you know, I'm a chair of a university or a chair of a college. You know, young people, when they were locked down for a year or so, weren't able to engage with people. A lot of social media beefs developed. And so there's all sorts of reasons why, but unfortunately, we are now seeing the consequences of several years of whatever it is that has happened to lead us to a situation where serious violent crime is going up and will continue to go up for the foreseeable future.
And of course, we have a huge reduction in police numbers and has been
yes,
for a long time.
And it's loss of experience. I always make the point, and we keep must making the point. Yes, they can replace the 21,000 officers and the 23,000 civilian staff, but not with people straight out of police school. You know, you've lost 20, 25 years experience each. You know, and that includes the connections, the contacts, the intelligence gathering. You've lost all of that, and it will take, maybe a decade to get to where we were just 10 years ago, where we were actually on top of crime, where crime was falling.
Mm. And I think just to finish this off, and you alluded to it, the worrying thing for those people of Liverpool, Merseyside, must be this man had nothing to do with this family, yet he smashed his way effectively through the front door of a completely innocent household.
Yeah, self-preservation. That's all it was. I mean, he was obviously targeted and decided that was what he was going to do. I don't know, would we do the same thing, you and I? You put your life first, again, I imagine, but it just goes to show, doesn't it? They just don't care, the fact that his fellow members, gang members, were able to come and collect him means they weren't that far away. So, he could have sought help or assistance from them, decided, however, to put this other family in jeopardy and lead to poor Olivia's death.
Well, our thoughts are with Olivia and her family at this tragic moment in time, and hopefully the people responsible will be brought to justice as soon as possible.
Absolutely.
I'm delighted to welcome Lee. Lee is, I've known Lee for a very long time. He is a firefighter. He'll tell us a lot more about his background. He's just got a book out. I will let him introduce his book and just give us a bit of an overview in terms of that. Lighthearted, Lee, let's have a chat in terms of the type of work that you've done. And I think we talk about criminal justice here. We talk about the emergency services. And of course, the firefighters are one of those emergency services, absolutely crucial element of keeping the public safe. And it'd be interesting to talk in terms of where that is at this present moment in time, if you've seen an increase in certain areas. And certainly firefighters have struggled, I know, with a lot of grassland fires, particularly with the huge amount of fantastic weather that we've had, although I think it's changed today. So, Lee, welcome.
Good morning. How are you all?
We're good, thanks. Good to see you, Lee. I need to say at the outset, because our listeners will probably not know, that I'm actually chairing the review of London Fire Brigade for the Commissioner and the Mayor of London. And so I'm due to report in November. So I might be a bit quieter than I normally am. But Lee, over to you. Tell us more about
the book. Thank you for having me on, firstly. I really appreciate the opportunity. Up in Smoke, Stories from a Life on Fire is out now. It came out last Thursday. The reason for me writing the book was one of, throughout my 25 years, I've always heard people ask me the same question: how do you do that job? A lot of people are curious, and unless you've actually needed in an unfortunate situation, you needed direct contact with the fire service, people know little about firefighters and fire brigade and fire stations. So there was that intrigue, and I thought, I have a great story, and it isn't just my story, it's a story about firefighters all over the UK and all over the world. We're a certain breed of animal. I think there's something quite fascinating about a group of individuals that want to run that way when everybody else is running that way. Call it bravery or courage or stupidity. there's many words.
So when did you start, Lee? When and where did you start?
I started in January 1997, so it was a while ago. I've gone into I've taken great time and effort to protect many details of incidents and people. And from the offset in the book, I've made this about my career and not specifically about anywhere. And I'd like to kind of keep that shroud of secrecy in where I'm from, quite secure, because it's not really about where I'm from, it's about what I do. And people have maybe an idea of what we do. So I decided to take let's humanize firefighters. Let's take off their PPE. Let's take off their breathing apparatus and find out what kind of individuals are doing that job. And in the book, you'll read or listen to in the audio version if that's what you get. You'll find out that they are some of the funniest individuals that you could ever meet. And I think there's an absolute reason why firefighters are all funny, why they've all got incredible senses of humour. Because as you can imagine, that going into some of the incidents that we do and seeing some of the trauma that we see, unless you have that ability to laugh, not insensitively, call it gallows humour, but unless you have that ability to depressurise with a bit of humour, you all go pop. You know,
so what made you join, Lee? What made you join?
Three generations. My grandfather, my father, and my uncle. It's been a family trade for what seemingly forever. I think collectively there's 107 years service between the four of us.
Because that would put some people off, wouldn't it? The fact that your two past relatives have done it, you might.
I think it was more of a rite of passage. I think a bit growing up around a fire station, you know, I was in a pram in a strike hut outside my dad's fire station in the 1977 strike. So I think I was always surrounded by men, and there wasn't any women at that time, but by men smelling of smoke.
Why was there no women in the? I mean, when did women come into the fire service?
I think there was a. She'll slap me for not remembering the exact date. It was a female firefighter in Norfolk, I think it was, and that was 1984.
So there was no females in the fire service prior to that.
Prior to that, I mean, in during the Second World War in the NFS, you had. A huge amount of women that were doing incredible work in the metropolitan, mainly metropolitan brigades areas, London, Manchester, you know, Liverpool, those key targets, doing fire watch and looking out for incendiary devices that were smouldering. They were an integral part of the fire service, and predominantly in control rooms, as is now, it's a predominantly female workforce now. You know, they are, whilst they're control operators to firefighters, they are firefighters in a control room as well, because their knowledge and abilities is so crucial to it, managing an incident and resolving an incident.
Yeah.
So I'd like to pay.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think there was a real growth from the mid 80s to the late 90s where women were coming in significant numbers. Mm. The other thing you just mentioned, your 25-year service, something I have learned during my review is people do stay a long time in the fire service. I mean, I've been seeing individuals getting 40-year medals, you know. I can't think of any other profession. You're thinking about the police service, Mark. Yeah, 30 years is usually the max, isn't it? But I've been seeing people getting 40-year medals. In fact, somebody in a control got 50-year. Medal. Gosh. I can't think. Can you imagine doing the same job for 50 years? I mean, it's quite extraordinary. Yeah. So there isn't much of a turnover. People must love the job to stay there as long as they do.
It's family away from family. And in the book, I talk a lot about that and the importance of that and the circle of trust, that intimate bond. I think when you work with a group of people for a large amount of time in an occupation like this, there is so much trust that you place upon one another, and there's a lot of banter, there's a lot of humour, that when you wake up in the morning or you're ready to go to work in the evening for a night shift, I still have that feeling of wanting to go to work. I can't wait to go to work. I really enjoy it, even 25 years down the line. My dad got a 44-year recognition, and to that, even on the last day, even now, he misses going to work. And I think that says a lot about the individuals that you work with, because the job, you know, you can do the same job in many different places, but just having that core circle of trust that you call family away from family is the reason people.
I mean, trust is pivotal, isn't it? Because you're going into a very dangerous situation. You have to be able to trust the people around you to keep you safe, and 100%. So that you can keep them safe, and that must be absolutely at the front of it all. You talked about the gallows humor. Give us some examples of the things that you're referring to in terms of the humorous side, if that's the right word, of the work that you were doing.
Again, I'll remain sensitive to the very sad things we see. I think, without going into a specific insensitive kind of gallows humor example, I think it's important that when you're working with your colleagues in quite a sad moment, that when you get back onto the fire truck, the atmosphere can be cut with a knife, and people, you'll return to station, and you will sit around a mess table, and maybe no one will say anything, but nobody needs to say anything because you've all witnessed the same thing in that moment just then. And then somebody will come out with something so inappropriate, maybe referring to the incident that's just happened, and it will make everybody laugh, and it will just depressurize instantly. Now, that's not to say that that moment was being insensitive to the individual that may have lost their life or their house or everything they know, but it's just that one thing where it was needed. And unless it's difficult to explain to anyone that doesn't work within high risk occupations how important that is.
For example, I know surgeons, and they will tell you that after an operation, they might have a laugh about something they saw or something. It's a human thing to be able to compress or compress whatever it is that you've been feeling. Absolutely right. Thinking more about the actual work that you've been doing, give us some examples of what you've covered in the book that would our listeners would love to be able to.
There's a story in there about an A&E department who have had a casualty. Let's call him a casualty that's coming to A&E with something stuck on his person, and they've got into the cubicle, and triage nurses and a couple of doctors have come in and said, like, we just haven't got any equipment to deal with taking that off. So much to the gasp of the casualty, they've said that the only thing we can do is call the fire brigade. And he's like, you've got to be kidding me. And like, we just haven't got anything to take that off. I mean, there's nothing left, it's your fault. So they have called the fire service. And with any fire crew that turns up anywhere, we're all nosy buggers. And you'd think that it would just need one person to go and make an assessment of what needs doing. But firefighters are a team, and we work as a team. So we go and assess things as a team. And having six, I mean, I was blessed that there wasn't a female firefighter on that crew on that day. But to go into a cubicle and it's six men all staring at what you've done is, it was like, in the end, it became, and firefighters are really good at decompressing and making somebody feel comfortable. It was a kind of, you've done what you've done. It is what it is, but we'll go and get what we need to get that off. And you should have seen his face when we brought in the really big jaws of life.
And did he keep it afterwards? That's the question. Did he what happened to it afterwards?
Of course,
did he keep
it's a memento, isn't it? It's obviously we didn't. The crew that removed it didn't use the jaws of life. We used a very intricate. It's like a thumb wheel, a little thumb saw, which we use to take off wedding rings that get stuck.
Right. Well, I'm glad you didn't go in with the acetylene. I think he'd know the difference. Growing up, you almost seem to think fire officers come to get the cat down from the tree. Have you ever done that? Got the cat down from the tree.
that's one of my taglines on Amazon. I think warning may contain cats up trees.
Is it really common or just a myth?
Do you get cats down from
trees? What do you think?
I'm sure I've seen a firefighter come and take a cat down from the tree.
Nazir, what do you think?
Well, it must be true. We've all been saying it all our lives.
Sure. If a cat climbs up a tree, it will eventually find its way down. But I, in my career, yes, I have climbed trees to get cats out of. I've climbed ladders up against lampposts to get squirrels down.
But I think that might be one of the reasons firefighters are so popular, isn't it? Because everyone loves a cat.
And not so much a squirrel. But absolutely.
It was easier to get the squirrel down, trust me.
I can imagine. So there you go. It's true. I didn't realise it was true.
Yeah.
I just guessed it. Yeah, I thought it was a myth.
Things have changed now. We don't instantly go and attend incidents like that. The RSP, things have changed because ultimately climbing a huge tree for a cat is a risk versus gain. Do firefighters want to risk their lives for a cat that climbed a tree? No, so there is a period of 48 hours that has to go past now before we attend.
So Lee, give us a bit of an insight into working shifts and kind of what would be, I know no day is the same as any other day, but how does it start? What happens?
So at the start of a shift, we will have our roll call. That will be in the appliance bay with our PPE. The officer in charge will designate various tasks to the crew on the line. That will be driving, breathing apparatus, casualty care. There are a number of things, depending on what station you're at and what appliances you've got. And then the crew will go and test their breathing apparatus sets. The driver will test, their lights and indicators and things like that, and pumps to make sure they work. Once everyone has tested what they're responsible for and gone to sign for those things, we'll all go into the mess, which is the word we use for a kitchen, a kind of seating area. And I think it's an old naval term, the mess, isn't it?
Mm.
I'm sure it's a naval term. And we'll have a cup of tea for maybe half an hour. The officer in charge will read out any important health and safety bulletins or information or emails that have come through between the shifts. And in that half an hour, as you can imagine, there's lots of people talking about what they do socially. Lots of banter, as you can well imagine, goes on in there. And then start of a day or start of a night shift where we do routines, testing equipment. We go out and practice pumping, putting up ladders, and making sure that all of our muscle memories for simple tasks are sharp. Because once we, as I talk about in my training, there's a reason why we do so much training. It's because we need to be able to almost not think about tasks.
Yeah, second nature.
At incidents, we need to be dealing with the incident, and they can unfold and develop very quickly. So having sharp instincts, like you say, and muscle memory around putting a ladder up or running out hose or pumping, or call it what you will, is quite important. And then there'll be periods of, we'll have our lunch. We might have a lecture. We might do some home fire safety visits where we go and visit people in their home to make sure their setup there is a safe one and they've got working smoke alarms on each level of their property.
And also businesses as well. I imagine businesses,
for sure, yeah,
restaurants,
yeah.
That kind of stuff, yeah. Anywhere with kitchens.
Yeah. So we go and visit them periodically annually to check that their setups are safe.
You do that as a whole team with the fire engine, and then if you get a call, you just divert to it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so our days and nights are full. I think there's this certain section of society are convinced that we just sit in fire stations drinking tea, playing pool, playing cards, call it what you will. But a firefighter's day in the modern fire and rescue service is very, very full and busy.
So I can imagine during the day, obviously, there's an awful lot. What about at night? I mean, do you get your head down and get sleep, or does that?
So part of our contract allows us to have downtime between midnight and 7 a.m. And that's in like a put me up bunk. But it's people like, but then I don't think they're designed to be. As you can imagine,
you take your own mattress along.
There's mattresses there.
Can you take your own one? So you got like a really, really comfortable.
I think that'd be inappropriate.
Your
own quilt and pillow.
You bring your own duvet and your own pillows. Yeah, I think you're
imagine?
Right.
You imagine, but I think I don't think they're made to be comfortable. Because if a house fire occurs at 3 a.m., you need to be up and awake. And people say, "Oh, you sleep at work." It's not asleep. You're subconsciously you are, and that's testament to how we wake up, semi dressed, get on that truck, and get out within 90 seconds. You know, you're not.
And do you use the stairs or do you go down the pole?
They must do the pole. Come on.
You have, come on, you've got to do the pole.
We still use poles.
Yes.
they're the fastest way down. Do you know there's an interesting fire station in Germany? I think it's in Munich. And they were having too many incidents where people were twisting ankles sliding down poles. But it is the quickest way from a dormitory into an appliance bay. Yeah. So they had this stainless steel 50-foot, 45-degree angle slide. Wow. Put him from their dorm to their bay, and they go down that. It's amazing.
Well, so, some of the big companies like Google, they in their headquarters, they have slides left, right, and center.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
But I think that's more to, I don't know, improve
a bit
the
of fun
work.
In the day.
Well, yeah, more fun. It's more about fun. I mean, I can't imagine Google need to go and do something in an emergency, do they?
No.
But it does sort of encourage people to work there because of the atmosphere it creates.
For sure.
I'm not saying the poll is about that, though, by the way. So.
No. A happy workplace is a healthy workplace.
Exactly.
And it must be the first time you jumped down a pole must have been quite good fun, mustn't it? I mean, I've always had that imagination of putting like a pole in the house and thinking that would be quite good fun.
I think you're giving something away there, Mark. What kind of pole dancing are you going to be doing?
Have you got a special room for that,
Mark? Yeah. Maybe that guy you mentioned earlier on. you obviously felt the need to write this book.
Yeah.
The actual process of writing, how did you find that?
Very long. I think coming up, having an idea for a book and then being able to, I felt it easier to record stories. As you can imagine, over the 25 years, I've got a wealth of stuff in my head. From hilarious to very harrowing. And I think every time I thought of a funny anecdote or a funny thing that happened or I witnessed, I literally got onto my voice messages on my phone and recorded it as I remembered it. So I ended up with a collection of audio that I could just keep going back to and almost transcribe. Onto the page. And
was that also a cathartic process as well, Leo? I could imagine.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Mark. It was very, very difficult at times. Things I thought I dealt with, especially around the mental health stuff and my journey with PTSD. I think resurrecting some of those boxes that I'd tucked away were quite it was quite something. And in a way, whilst a lot of them are very sad, it was almost an opportunity for me to absolutely make sure that I dealt with that incident and allowed myself to tuck it back in its box back there in my memory bank and be comfortable with Lee, just talk
a little bit. I think one of the things that Nazir and I have always been very open about is mental health and the impact of men, mental health. Traditionally, men are very poor at talking about them.
Yeah.
How did you deal with it? I mean, what were the types of issues that you were having to face with mental health?
I'm very lucky. I think firefighters generally are very lucky with the support that their services offer. I think because being in the industry of trauma and exposure to trauma that's what we do. Our services nationwide, their occupational health teams are very proactive in making sure that people have access to mental health support. I think you're absolutely right, men. There's this bravado thing, and men generally don't want to admit that they're broken. And it took a while for me to, you know, for me to actually say, do you know what, I'm screwed. I need help.
Did you feel broken?
Yeah, completely. Yeah, completely broken. You know, I've dealt with some very, very tragic incidents over my career. And you almost, it's the incident's one thing. I think it's the reflection and absorbing the emotion from people that survive that are related to the people that died, that, you know, you're in their company for moments or minutes or hours. And it's those things that when you look back and they keep playing over and over in your head, you know, paying witness to that can be quite, especially when it's accumulative as well over a career, it can mess you up. And I think that it's so important that if this interview and people listening to it take anything away from it, is, and I don't want to sound cliche, but when, you know, when we say it's okay not to be okay, you know, I didn't want to hear that when I was going through it. I was like, no, I'm a firefighter. This is what I do. It's, you know, I shouldn't be feeling sad and broken. It was the best thing I ever did. I felt like once I started that journey, it was tough. It was tough talking about things, but having access and being able to talk to professionals and take yourself, it was almost like I got my life back. Well, I did get my life back. You know, it wasn't like I thought.
Lee, I mean, this generation of men are finding it easy, a little bit easier. Given that your father and your grandfather were working in the fire service, do you recollect how they handled trauma? Were they? I don't know.
I think it was unspoken. It was almost a, it's what we do. Suck it up, get on with it. My dad would, I was introduced to quite gory things quite early on in my life. You know, my dad would come home and, you know, even around the dinner table, it was almost like a, like say, the gallows humour. And it kind of softened it for me when I actually became a firefighter, because there was, I already knew what an RTC may have looked like. So. I don't ever remember my granddad talking about anything traumatic.
Yeah, but I think the point that Mark makes is about it is absolutely essential that we do talk. We haven't got any superpowers, I'm afraid. And you know, I come across just like you in prosecuting, in police, in the fire service, in any area where you're dealing with trauma, you will suffer trauma. And, you know, I can think of so many occasions in which I just bottled it up and thought, oh, hang on a minute, you know, I'm supposed to deal with it. It's my job. But it's not, you know. And it's absolutely key that we send out the message that you sent out, Lee, which is, you know, go and find somebody to talk to. Don't think that you are immune to this, that you'll get over it. Just recently, I was talking to a firefighter who was at Grenfell, and he turned up at 5 in the morning, so 4 or 5 hours after the fire started. I'm in the car with him, and I said to him, "Did you see anything?" And he started this. He said, "Yeah, I saw some children," and then he just stopped. There was nothing else to that sentence, and I thought, "I really hope you're getting some help for this," because he couldn't finish the sentence, and this is 5 years on. So yeah, the idea that you can recover from trauma just because, I don't know, it's your job, it's just nonsense, isn't it?
No, for sure. I think many organisations, you know, in emergency services, arena, fire brigade, police, ambulance, they all have occupational health teams. But I'm trying to champion a different way forward. I'm trying to champion a look and asking these, especially my service, asking them to look at the other end of the journey. Can we build resilience into our new colleagues? Can we build resilience into our existing colleagues that maybe not haven't been absorbed, haven't been exposed to trauma? You know, we have access to mental health support at this end, but you're damaged. You know, can we? Is there an opportunity to build resilience into people. Now, I'm going to name drop here a lady called Jackie Wilmshurst, and she has developed a program called Managing Psychological Safety, MAPS, for short. And after my very last tragic incident, she put me through her MAPS program, and it was about, it was about understanding what it is you saw, heard, smelled, tasted, and breaking everything down into small, manageable parts and processing those individual aspects so that the whole experience isn't overwhelming. And when you break things down, I mean, I've summed that up in a very, very short time, amount of time, but when you break things down into small parts and you process them individually, at the end, you've processed it all, but you are in a much healthier place, because trying to process the entire event is just too much for everyone. And if you can imagine that over a career as well, accumulatively, that's when people get absolutely overwhelmed and their heads full of stuff that they can't process. So, you know, her, she's looking at the other end, and she's asking organizations to say, look, I have a program of resilience building. Let's give this to people at this end of their career so that they're less likely to need the other end.
Lee, I think those are really, I mean, I've had my own struggles with mental health. And I think one of the massive issues that anyone going through a mental health issue is that they're not receptive. You know, so when you're in a mental health crisis, you are not receptive to anything. You don't understand that actually the things that people are trying to help you with are positive for you. So what we have to do is we have to put that into somebody prior to reaching any mental health crisis, so that they then are in a position when it comes to it, they then go, actually, do you know what? I can now start to implement some of them. Because otherwise, what you have to do is you have to deal with that mental health crisis as best you can. And then it's only when you come out the other side of it, if you come out the other side of it, that you're in a position where you start thinking, actually, do you know what? If I'd have done that, or if I'd have had that. So I think it's brilliant. You know, I'm all for, you know, we're much better. We talk about it more, but we do still need to help people. You know, the first time I had a panic attack and anxiety, you know, I didn't know what that was. I thought I was having a heart attack, you know, and I think, you know, who discusses that? Where do those conversations come from? And we're much better, but I still think we've got a long way to go. And I think we've got a long way to go in terms of getting in there early to help people understand.
Absolutely, 100%. And I believe that, and I've always said it, and my granddad said it to me, my dad said it to me, and it was one of the reasons I wrote the book. Laughter is the best medicine. And if you can exist in a team where it's like a fear-free environment, and because you've built up those circles of trust and intimacy and banter, that you can laugh at each other, at yourself. It's so important. You know, life's tough. Life can be extremely difficult, stressful. And I believe that we all have to just be a little bit more lighthearted and not take everything too seriously, and be able to smile. And because I think, you know, when we laugh and we smile, we feel good. It's a good feeling. It releases incredible hormones and chemicals in your body. And I think to be able to, you know, to be able to put your hand up and almost with a smile say, I'm broken, I need help.
Give us another funny story from the book.
there's a story in there about a crew going into, they've been called to a care home, and they arrive, and the officer in charge is met by a carer. And she says, oh, you know, Mr. let's call him Mr. Smith, he's upstairs. And the officer in charge goes into the shower cubicle, and there's Mr. Smith, and he's sat in a shower hoist in a wet room. And he's like, good morning, good morning. And the officer in charge is like, okay, so what's the issue? What's the problem? And she said, under the towel. So the officer in charge says, can I have a quick look, Mr. Smith? He's like, yeah, no problem. I shouldn't have sat down on it. So what Mr. Smith had done, and he even obviously in his own admission said, I shouldn't have sat down on that. In the wet rooms, you have a rubber waffle chair. which allows the water to drain through. And when you're in, obviously sat in a hoist, it's the best kind of chair to have. But a section of the waffles in the middle had split open. So as Mr. Smith had sat down on the waffle chair, his testicles had passed through what had been a stretched opening of waffle formation.
Yeah.
And of course, once you're in, you ain't coming out. And he was very, very, he obviously found the funny side to it. Obviously he couldn't move around as much because he was in so much pain. But again, it was like, the only way we're going to be able to get you out of this, Mr. Smith, is with a Stanley knife and a very delicate, sensitive, steady pair of hands. But he was like, oh my God. I think it was about 45 minutes the crew took to cut that waffle chair away from his testicles.
Yeah.
All the time with him like, please don't slip.
Given what you said earlier on about risk assessment, the whole team was in there watching.
Of course. I mean, there was only room for four people, but six firefighters got in there.
Yeah. Honestly, it's lovely talking to you, Lee. It really has been. Tell us Fantastic. More about it. So tell us where we can get the book. So
Up in Smoke, Stories from a Life on Fire is available online in most good online retailers. I won't name drop them because I can't name drop them all. But if you just give it a search, Lee is spelled L-E-I-G-H.
Yep.
I have my parents to thank for that. I've been correcting everybody for my entire life. Yeah. And Hosey Pickett, I mean, you couldn't get more socialist and fire service relevant, could you, Hosey Pickett?
Yeah.
That's HOSY-PICKETT. When I introduce myself as a firefighter and they say, Hosey Pickett, you've made that up, right?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. It's actually genuinely my name. I'm on Twitter as well, at Hosey_Pickett. The audiobooks, I've done the audiobook. I recorded that. I'm very happy with that. It gives the story authenticity because it's my voice. It's me telling it. And it's on ebook as well. Whatever your fancy, there's a version there for you.
Brilliant.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much. It's been really, illuminating. Really has been.
Brilliant. You look after yourself, Lee.
Thank you, guys. Nazir,
fascinating. And I think one of the things that really comes out of that is this whole aspect of care. You know, I think maybe sometimes we just forget, you know, firefighters are as frontline as the police service with dealing with trauma.
Well, I don't know. Do we forget it? I think we're so self-centered these days that we don't really think about anybody else and what trauma they may be encountering. The description that Lee had, which we've all talked about, you know, people in the emergency services run towards trouble that we are running away from. And we don't really appreciate that. And we seem to think, well, they're just doing their job. No, it's not the same. They are keeping us safe. And I think we need to recognize that. But I think the broader conversation that Lee initiated around mental health was really key here. You know, if there's any strong message we get out of today's session with Lee, it's that, you know, it doesn't matter how strong you think you are. It doesn't matter. What your upbringing and all the rest of it. At the end of the day, you need to talk about what's going on in your lives and accepting that there's something wrong is the beginning of a journey to fixing it.
Absolutely. And interesting, the family element of it. You know, I hadn't really thought about it in terms of the length of time people stay in the fire service. You know, 25 years, 40 years. You know, police service now, there are fewer and fewer people who are staying in for that 30 years. And I guess some of that camaraderie in one way helps, but also might make it more difficult because the closer you are, perhaps the harder it is sometimes for tough men to show, you know, they do have a vulnerable side.
Well, the concept of family works in all sorts of positive and negative ways. You know, there are lots of things that I would never share with my family about what's going on in my life. And I think that's, you know, if you think of the people around you that you work with as your family, again, you know, you may not necessarily want to talk to them about what's going on because you might think that's going to be used against you in some way or might undermine their view or perception of you. So, you know, absolutely, there's a positives and negatives in anything, in any relationship in the workforce. And particularly the longer you've been in the same group of people, probably more difficult, I think, to speak about what's going on.
Brilliant. Well, listen, fascinating book. Up in Smoke is available from all retailers, good retailers anyway, and you can buy it, of course, online, or you can listen to the audiobook. Nazir, as always, fantastic talking to you.
Brilliant.
Please do continue to send us emails or any comments with regards to this podcast. We love to hear from you, and we do reply to every single one. And you can subscribe to Fear or Favour through any of the podcast networks. So thank you very much. Look after yourself, and we'll see you very soon.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kays, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.